Hey everyone, how's it going? Welcome back to the History of Video Games. My name is Wes, and I'm here, as always, with the wonderful Ben. How you doing today, Ben?
I'm doing good. How are you, Wes?
I'm doing pretty great. A little tired, just got back from a road trip vacation, but it was a good time, so I am refreshed and ready to be back recording, talking about video games, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, when you were gone for a week, which hopefully our viewers didn't even notice because we planned it out.
Right, right.
Which I feel extra proud about. I definitely want to brag about it. Yeah. But you were gone for a week, and man, I played like 7 games when you were gone. I don't know what happened. I know. And I like beat them. I didn't just like quit after an hour.
Oh, dang. Oh, well, I'm excited to hear about at least some of them.
Yeah.
Tell me what you've been playing, man.
Yeah, if I don't say it soon, I'm just going to forget everything. That's what I'm worried about. I think I'm going to quick just summarize. I think on our last recording, I mentioned that I had beaten Rainbow Six Rogue Spear's main campaign. And after that, I did play through all 3 expansion packs and beat them. Most of them were pretty short. I think the last expansion pack was the longest. I had 10 missions in it. But the second expansion pack only had 3 missions in it, so that one was real short. But they were good. They were just kind of more of the same. They had some hard missions, but nothing that was as hard as the main campaign of the main game, so it was fine. It was just kind of more the same. But the real next game I went to, and that'll be the one I really wanted to talk about today, is a game from one of my Humble Bundles, and I just picked this game at random. I didn't know anything about it. I wasn't sure if it was like a 3D game or a 2D game or what it was, but the game is called Book of Demons.
Okay.
And this one kind of confuses me, because everything about it is kind of like, you wouldn't think it's fun, but then it's actually really fun. You're like, how am I having fun? But the game, it kind of feels like a mobile game, because the combat in it, it's kind of this isometric view. And for the combat, you just click on the enemy. And no matter what class you play, even the swordsman guy, he will attack it as soon as it becomes like visible to his light radius, which is just slightly smaller than the complete size of the screen. So it's basically like he has a ranged attack. And all you do for combat is just click on things, and slowly their health goes down and they die. And that's the combat. like your character is like literally on rails. So if you think about like being on rails, you can kind of like move forward down the rail or go backward down the rail, and that's it. So there's not a whole lot of like dodging mechanics, you know? The movement in the game feels kind of clunky in general. So it's not like you're going to be dodge rolling your way out of enemies, you know? You'd mostly attack from range, and if they get too close to you, you try to back up, and that's kind of the extent of the combat. And you would think, well, that's pretty lame. You know, this is meant for like one finger on an iPad or something.
Right.
But then it's actually really fun. So I'll try to explain that part of it. For the combat, like how they make it fun is they just make it so that there's a lot going on that you have to keep your eye about, and kind of, it's almost more of like a management game where there's just a lot of priorities and things you have to click. So for example, some of the enemies are like invulnerable after you hit them once for like 2 seconds, and then you have to go back to them and hit them again 2 seconds later. So it kind of encourages you to kind of click them and then hop away and click some other things and then go back and click them again. You've got like poison, which to cure poison, you have to click on your health file. You can get stunned, and your equipment, which is kind of shown at the bottom of the screen, becomes unequipped, and you have to click your equipment slots to re-equip them quickly. There are certain pieces of equipment that kind of like drop hearts on the ground, which heal you. So you kind of need to scroll your cursor over them to pick them up. So there's just kind of a lot of things taking your attention that you need to click all the time. And so that's kind of where the fun of the game is, and just kind of prioritizing the right things. And I ended up really liking the game. The game is a roguelike, but it has the option to turn on roguelike difficulty and permadeath. So it said for first time playthrough, you should not put permadeath on. And I was like, okay, I'll do what you tell me to. And I'm glad I did, because I got to see the whole, you kind of go from level 0 in the dungeon to level 100, and that's the end of the game. So I got to see the whole thing, and it still took me like 10 hours to get through. a whole dungeon, even with permadeath off, but it was just a nice time. There's a very large amount of enemies, so every time you sit down to play, you see new enemies, and the whole game is just kind of like seeping in style. The art style is really cool. It's kind of this like a cardboard cutout style or something. It's okay, almost hand-drawn. It's really nice style. All the characters are memorable. Really good voice acting. There's like a little town, which is kind of like your base of operations. And there's like little characters in the town that you interact with. And they were really fun and cool and had nice personalities. So the whole thing was just kind of like seeped in character and polish. And I just couldn't stop playing it. The only reason I stopped playing it was like I beat the entire dungeon and I went back to play some of the other classes, and I realized a lot of the equipment cards, which I was thinking was kind of going to give you different builds and stuff to kind of replay the game. A lot of them, I saw like new ones and I was like, well, this isn't as good as the ones I already had or the ones I would have like picked up later. So I didn't feel like I had that replayability value that other games like Dead Cells have. So that's the only reason why I stopped playing. If they had more equipment, I think I would have kept playing. I would definitely recommend it. Maybe not at like full price, but if it goes on sale or something, I think it would be an easy pickup because I actually really enjoyed it. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah, Book of Demons. If you want to try something that's really unique and maybe a little, it's kind of chill, but then has intense moments at the same time, the perfect game. So,
interesting.
I really liked it.
Yeah, that's not what I've heard of before, but it sounds very cool and very weird and like it might be up my alley, so
yeah,
good to know.
I think you would like it, Wes. It's different though. I would say because I didn't feel the need to keep replaying it, it's one of those games I think getting it on sale for like $10 or something is gonna be a good decision.
Right.
But cool. Yeah, I can definitely recommend it. I was surprised because as soon as I saw the combat, I'm like, well, this is gonna be boring. You know? And then it wasn't.
Nice.
Yeah, so
very cool.
That's one of the things I played and kind of completed. Have you been able to play anything over your vacation?
Well, not so much over my vacation, although I did bring the Switch with me and mostly played Pokemon Go on my phone, but also got a little bit of time in on Pokemon Violet. Just some random stuff there. But what I want to talk about is one of the things I missed and was trying to catch up on a little bit over my vacation is Tarkov. Escape from Tarkov had another wipe, which if you aren't familiar with the Tarkov game cycle and community, it's still a game that's being updated.
Is it still technically in like beta or is it actually out?
It is still technically in beta, yeah.
Gotcha.
Although it's, I mean, basically a full released game at this point. But as they do big updates, they'll occasionally wipe everyone's progress and everyone starts from zero, and it's kind of the excitement around the game revolves around that. So it's always exciting when a new wipe happens, and this one brought a lot of cool changes and a lot of small stuff that may not seem really significant at first. Like usually they're like a whole new map is in, or you know, we added 10 new guns, and because the game is so detailed with its gun stuff, that's a huge deal if there's 10 new guns. But this one just had a lot of quality of life stuff, which I didn't realize the game was missing. But boy, I think it's going to make it a lot more easy for people to get into. I know I've recommended this game to a couple friends and they load in, play one match, see the amount of game knowledge you have to just like feel like you have any idea what's going on. And they're like, I don't know if I want to spend the time playing this game, understandably. But there's a lot of stuff that makes it easier to equip your character with available weapons, armor, backpacks, and stuff like that in between raids, which is one thing that Tarkov is, I feel like, a little notorious for. Many people spend like 30 minutes looking for and building their guns and doing all this stuff, and then they get into the match, it takes 5 minutes to load into the match, you die in 2 minutes, and then you go on this 30-minute cycle again. But making that process of getting set up quicker makes it feel a lot less bad when you get destroyed instantly. And hopefully that doesn't happen all the time, but it makes it feel a lot better. They've also added some more dynamic stuff to the AI enemies on the maps. So they move around a bit more and it kind of keeps you on your toes, makes it so that maps aren't always played the same way. Because, you know, when people always knew where the AI would be, they knew how to get around them, they knew how to counter them, but now they could be anywhere. And in a similar vein, previously in Tarkov, all of the places where you loot stuff that, you know, you sell or you use to build your base or stuff like that once you get out of the raid, all those containers were in the same spots every single time you played a map. And now they can switch locations. So that means that instead of what used to happen, where people would run in with just an axe or just a melee weapon, grab all the stuff they could and run out so that there was minimal risk, they don't know where those locations are anymore, and it makes the gameplay, again, more dynamic. You never know where you're going to run into fights, whereas usually you'd be like, oh, well, this loot container is here, so I know that there's going to be other people here. Now it's not a guarantee, and that really, I haven't played too much of it. I only got to do a couple raids, but from what I could tell, I mean, you're not doing the same routine that you usually do when you play the game, and I think it's going to be hopefully a exciting and healthy change for the game to keep it more interesting for longer, because you never know what each round is going to bring. So yeah, it's, yeah, you know, not exciting big ticket stuff, but impactful stuff that from the little bit of experience I've had with it and the what I've been seeing other people say about it who are playing it, it seems like a good change.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to let me know how it pans out as the season goes on.
Yes, will do. If I don't totally drop it and spend the rest of my life playing Baldur's Gate 3,
that which is happen. Also
a possibility. You never know.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what I've been up to recently.
Cool. I'm glad you've gone back to that. Like, we have some old games to talk about as well.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's why we're here.
Yeah. Yep. There's been one developer in particular that we have mentioned many times throughout the podcast, a young text adventure programmer named Greg Hassett, and he kind of made his last game not too long ago, in 81, I believe, and we have already mentioned it in an honorable mention, but I thought we should do kind of a special topic, kind of looking at his entire library of work, along with the company that he was most known to associate with, Mad Hatter Software, which is also kind of like going out of business in 1981. So we'll put them together on our website and under the dev section after this episode. But I thought it would be kind of interesting to maybe look back and see what these guys have actually done and contributed to the history of video games.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me get started with Greg Hassett himself and a little bit about him. He has made, as Ben mentioned, several games that we've covered. All of them, except for I think one or two, were text adventures. And he has made them in both BASIC and assembly code language. He started apparently switching to assembler code language after he was getting fed up with the limitations of BASIC coding language. But he started making these games in 1978. And in 1978, he was only 12 years old. And between 1978 and 1980, I think he made 10 text adventures. And so he was only 14 by the time that he had finished making all these games. And they were fairly competent games too. I mean, with some of the spelling errors and theming, you could tell it was made by a kid, but it wasn't like they were incredibly inferior software. Like, for the time, they were pretty dang good text adventures. So it's very impressive that he was doing this at 12 to 14 years old. He originally sold his first game, which was called Journey to the Center of the Earth, to the Software Exchange, and he lived in the New England area, and I think the Software Exchange was based out of Milford, New Hampshire, so it's probably somebody who was close by to him, and he sold that for $150, but then he made a revised version of Journey to the Center of the Earth and ended up selling that to Mad Hatter Software, which was also based out of New England in Dracut, Massachusetts. And Mad Hatter Software, they do make other games, but almost every time we're mentioning them, it's because they're publishing a Greg Hassett text adventure. Mm-hmm. And we could find basically no information on this company. So we don't have any idea if maybe it was somehow associated with Hassett, like maybe he had some family members who ran it, and that's why they picked up so many of his games. Or maybe it was just location based, and, you know, they're going to be going away in 1981, kind of the same with Greg Hassett's game making career. So maybe they weren't affiliated at all outside of their business, and Greg Hassett's game was just all that was making them money.
Right.
Because, you know, they weren't as popular as the Scott Adams games, but they were pretty popular text adventures. So I could totally see that being a possibility too. But anyway, back to Greg, when he was 14, towards the end of his game making career, he founded a company, his own company called Adventure World, to publish games alongside the games that he was already putting through Mad Hatter Software. I think he published all his own games through Adventure World as well. And at one point, he was interviewed. He commented that his company was netting him about $800 a month, which, like, that's pretty dang good for a 14-year-old in 1980 to be making $800 a month on your own company.
Yeah.
So he was very industrious, although I believe in the interview he also said that, you know, it doesn't take away from his social time, and really he just wants to sit around and do nothing during the summer. So he was still very much a 14-year-old at heart. And a couple years later, after he stopped making a bunch of games in 1984, he did end up writing an article for a computer magazine talking about how to write adventure games. And it's clear in that article that much of his influence was from the original Colossal Cave adventure game. And you can definitely see that in a lot of his games, although he does try to change around the formula a little bit too.
So you're telling me like a 10-year-old could beat that game and I can't?
Yes, that's what I'm telling you. Although I think the first paragraph of the article said it can take people days, weeks, even months to master the game. So he understood that it's a hard game to beat.
Yeah, that's okay.
So yeah, I'm not sure how long his company Adventure World will stick around. It might kind of fade away in 81, just like he does. And we don't really have much from Greg left on our timeline. So I'm wondering if maybe him going into 10th grade, you know, kind of took his attention away from video games for a bit.
It must have, because I searched on the internet for him, because a lot of like older developers have over the years came back to the community after having like a life and been like, yeah, I was the guy that made this, you know, here's an interview with Blue Ranger or something, you know. And Greg Hassett just hasn't popped up. He left and nobody's ever heard of him since. So I hope he's doing well. Because he was so young at the time of making these games, I think he would be in his 50s now. So it's not like he's super old. So maybe we will still see him pop up someday. But as far as the games he made back starting in 1978, as you mentioned, Journey to the Center of the Earth was his first text adventure. I believe it was a Collect the Treasures adventure, but I don't remember. I did review it a long time ago. But after that one, he did The House of Seven Gables, which I think maybe you did, Wes. I'm not totally sure. Mm-hmm. I definitely did the next one, Voyage to Atlantis. It's also sometimes called Journey to Atlantis. Then in 79, I believe, we've got Sorcerer's Castle that he did, King Tut's Tomb, Enchanted Island Adventure, Mystery Mansion, and I think in 80 going into 81, we've got World's Edge Adventure, which he did, Curse of the Sasquatch, and his last text adventure was called Devil's Palace. And then I only found one game that was not a text adventure that he made. He published it through Adventure World, as you mentioned, his own company. And it's the only game that I found that Adventure World is credited with publishing. I'm not saying he didn't publish the other ones under it, but
right,
they all had like real publishers too. Mm-hmm. Whereas this game, I think it was just under his own company, which is called Fasteroids. And it was a Asteroids clone on the TRS-80. I think all of these text adventures were on the TRS-80 only. Maybe some of the early ones were on mainframe. I can't remember, but this is largely text adventures on the TRS-80 with no visuals. I think most of them are collected treasures, but I think there are some story-based ones in there. As for Mad Hatter Software, the company that published all these games, they did publish a lot of other games. I found they republished a whole bunch of stuff from Personal Software, which includes the Bob Bishop games, which I don't know why they did that, because those games were already available, published by other publishers. But I don't know, maybe they had some sort of other reach or went to a new market with them or something, I don't know. But they also published games that Adventure International made, that Creative Computing made. they started publishing games way back in 78 with games like Othello, a game called Magic Island, which is a Hammurabi game, Pollution Game, that's the name of it, Pollution Game, which is another Hammurabi one. I found a game called Galactic Blockade Runner, which sounds like a unique space adventure game, but it seems to be lost. I couldn't find any images of it or anything. There's another game called Yacht Race that they made, which was a sailboat board game type grid-based game. Solaria, which is another Hammurabi game. I think all these are in 78 or 79. We've got Slot Machine 2, Real-Time Lunar Lander, Boggle, which is like a mastermind game, something called Demo Program, which had like craps and tic-tac-toe on it, which, you know, all these are kind of very generic games that all computer publishers made and published. The only two that we really covered on the timeline, we covered one that we did review called Quest, which was a different text adventure made by a different person under Mad Hatter Software, and I believe was well-received. It was a graphical text adventure to some extent. So that one was cool. It came out in 80, and I believe you did cover that one. And then the follow-up to that was called Sleuth by Mad Hatter Software, which was another simple graphical text adventure. So those are the only like two big games that they came out with that we have good resources for that were not Greg Hassett. So I think towards the end of their run, they were trying to do some other things, but Greg Hassett was the bulk of their sales for sure. But yeah, that's all the games by Greg Hassett and Mad Hatter Software. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to really be talking about them again. So Greg Hassett was really big in the early days of text adventures in 78 and 79. Now that we're getting into graphical text adventures, I don't know that he would have been able to keep up, even if he did keep making text adventures. I don't know. But yeah, I don't think we'll hear from him again. So
the end of an era.
Yeah, yeah. There's a new era, and I'm going to be actually reviewing a graphical text adventure in today's episode. So why don't we get over there and we'll talk about it. Hello and welcome back to the History of Video Games. Let's start off today's episode talking about some arcade games. We've got one here called Space Fortress by Century. Came out sometime in 1981. We are in April of 1981, but this one we didn't have a month date for. Now this one seemed kind of like a half Galaxian, half Space War type of game. It was just okay, but we've seen a lot of those games lately and a lot of them looked a lot better than this.
All right, but the next arcade game we have here is an interesting game that we don't really see too often. It is a pool arcade game called Tri-Pool by Noma, Casino Tech, and Coastal Games. And because we don't see these a lot, I had to take a look at it, so I'm going to do a review of Tri-Pool. So the cabinet itself had some nice colors. Overall, pretty simple, though, honestly. I mean, I guess you can only do so much with pool. So there wasn't really too much going on there, but as the name implies, it does have three different types of pool games that you could play on this. You could play either straight pool, which is just normal billiards, as most people play it, I think, and then nine ball, and then one called snooker, which I've never heard of before. I tried to look up a little bit about it, and apparently it was made by like English officers posted in India, but it sounds really confusing, so I'll be honest, I didn't even try playing that one. And it does say in the flyer that you can put the English on the ball.
Oh, man.
Which is a phrase that me and Ben have loved since first hearing it in, I think it was like an early Odyssey Pong tennis game.
Yeah.
And basically it means adding a left or right curve to the ball, but put the English on it. You know, it's a great phrase. So if they have that in there, we're going to review it. That's not a guarantee, but
I've heard people use it like in the modern day to describe like baseball pitches. Like out of nowhere, I'll be watching a baseball game and the old announcer guy's like, and he really put the English on that one. I'm like, where did you hear that from? Like, nobody says that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I get the feeling it was definitely like a common sports term in the 70s. But yeah, I feel like you don't hear people say it anymore. But apparently it's still around. But
I love it, man.
Yeah. And so it's great that this game has it too. You know, always makes it more interesting when you can do more stuff with the cue ball.
So when you say put the English on it, you controlled the spin post hit, or was it more like if you hit it to the side, it spins that way like in real pool?
I couldn't figure out exactly how to do the English in the backspin. I kind of got backspin, but it seems like you indicate how much you want to do it before you hit it, and then it reacts. Okay. You don't control it after the hit, at least as far as I can tell.
No homing missile of a ball.
Yeah, that'd be pretty busted in pool anyway, I think.
You can make some pretty cool shots, though.
Yeah, that's true. But for the gameplay, it does play three different games of pool, like I mentioned, and it kind of plays exactly like you think it would. I mean, it just plays a straightforward game of pool. You control what they call the phantom cue ball, but really it's just a cursor that, you know, you're deciding which direction and where exactly you want to hit the ball. And then you can give it backspin or left to right English before you hit it. In nine ball, you have to sync the balls in order from 1 through 9. And snooker, like I said, was kind of confusing, but it has 22 balls, which is more than a normal pool. And there's two different colors for all the balls, and the players hit them in a certain order or something like that. And then, of course, you have classic straight pool, where you just have to hit them in and hit the 8 ball in last to win. Interestingly, I don't think this did the classic stripes or solids, even if you were playing two-player. It's just all solids, and anyone can hit any ball in except for the 8 ball, which maybe there's a version of pool that's like that, and I've never played, but I feel like stripes and solids is the most common way to play it.
Right.
But honestly, that's basically it. It's a pool game. You can actually control where the pool cue is going, which is nice. Oh, I didn't mention, but you can't really, I mean, you can and you can't control the how hard you hit it, which is weird. Like, you don't push a button to hit it harder or like hit a number to hit it harder. There's just a little image of a pool stick that's starts at the bottom of the screen, goes up a little bit, then goes back to the bottom. And that indicates like how much power it'll give the ball. Like, the further the stick is on the screen, that means it's going to give it more power when you hit it. But it just goes in a cycle. Like, I guess it's supposed to emulate that thing that people are doing where you go back and forth on your finger with the pool stick before you hit it. But it's just weird because it makes it like a timing game to time it based on what power level you want to hit it at instead of just like hitting the power level. So that part of it's a bit weird, but you can control the power. It's just like on this little timed cycle thing. But let me get into my ratings now, talk about the game a little bit more. For graphics, I give it a 2.75 out of 10. It's just a simple pool game, you know, but Tri-Pool has lots of great colors in it, and it's really refreshing to see. I feel like not a lot of the pool games we've seen, and we haven't seen a lot, to be fair, but I feel like most of them looked pretty bland. This one has different colors for all of the balls, which is great. So they all look very distinct, and they all have a number on the top of them as well. The pool table itself is also fairly well detailed. You have the holes, which look pretty good, the green of the center, and there's actually a little bit of kind of decoration and wood looking stuff on the outside of the table as well. So that all looks great. You can't see your stick on the table, but as I mentioned, you can see it off to the side of the screen, indicating how much power you're going to hit with. The balls actually look like balls, which is nice, instead of squares. And they don't really have a rolling animation to them, which isn't that great. They just sort of slide around, so it looks a little goofy. But I do feel like the way that they bounce off each other when they're all clumped up together and when they're hitting against the walls looks pretty realistic, and it's pretty good physics, and it looked believable in that way. So, you know, it's still a simple game visually, but I really appreciate the detail and color that is in there. Moving on to sounds, I give it a 2 out of 10 here. mainly because there aren't too many sounds in this game. Most of them are just strange beeps. Like, for some reason, they thought there needed to be a constant noise anytime you're moving your cursor, which is pretty annoying, but it wasn't too bad. And the scoring noise is also a series of beeps that sounds okay. It's kind of something we've heard of before, but it also had a descending version of that that kind of went boo-doo-doo when the cue ball went in instead of an actual scoring ball. So I like that. And the best sound in the game, and the main reason I gave it a 2 out of 10, is that definitely the balls hitting each other, which is a really nice, like, hollow clicking sound that's just a pretty good computer version of pool balls hitting each other. So I enjoyed that a lot. And now for gameplay, I only gave it a 2.5 out of 10 here. For the most part, I mean, Tri-Pool plays a good game of pool with some nice options for three different game modes and the ability to play two-player. And I think the physics of the balls hitting each other feels pretty realistic. And I do like that there are options to add English and backspin, even though I was having a little trouble figuring out how to do them on the emulator. But I did have some issues with the gameplay too. I mean, for the power of your shot, like I mentioned, it's this weird time-based thing where you just have to wait until it's at the right power level that you want and then hit the button. It works okay, but it just felt a little bit weird and cumbersome. And also, the balls hitting each other, I feel like, is simulated pretty well. Their movement after they hit each other and their acceleration can be really uneven. Like, I feel like I've hit the cue ball off a ball, and then a ball adjacent to it goes flying and bounces off the wall, and it looks like it should slow down pretty fast, but then all of a sudden it'll pick up speed and go like into a pocket. Like, for the most part, the physics are good, but just every now and then the balls just keep rolling, and it doesn't make any sense compared to like pool as I know it, playing it. So that kind of took me out of it a little bit. I was like, this doesn't really feel like I'm making the shots I should make. And I also wish that they had stripes and solids for when you're playing two-player standard pool. It's kind of weird to just be able to score any ball. Like, it takes the strategy out of it if you don't have to avoid the solids to get to the stripes and all that. So that was a little bit of a bummer to me. So moving on to gameplay, I gave it a 5 out of 10 here. We're going to see a few clones of it, so at least a few people were into Tri-Pool. But I don't think it's terribly relevant. I mean, it's probably the best pool arcade game we've seen so far, so that's pretty great. You know, when you take into account the colors, the sounds, and the physics. But it doesn't really add much that we haven't seen before. It just does it in a cleaner, more colorful way. So I don't think it's doing huge innovations for the genre, but it is a pretty solid game. So then overall, I ended up giving it a 2.5 out of 10. Tri-Pool is a fun little pool arcade game and has nice gameplay options and good graphics, but it just doesn't totally feel like right to play. Something feels a little bit off with the physics, but I did enjoy it, and I hope it's a stepping stone for more pool video games, but it's still not at that point like pinball video games where I would rather play it than actual pool. Like, I'd still just rather go play the pool that's right next to this arcade cabinet.
Yeah. Was there an AI mode in this? Or you just, one player was just you playing?
One player was just you playing for points. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just basically to see how many turns you could get the balls in. And I should say, because it's an arcade cabinet, there were like, quote unquote, lives. Like, you could only scratch or not hit a ball with the cue ball, I think, 3 times before you got a game over. So there was sort of that timer on single player, but single player did feel a little weird.
All right, all right. Well, I'll tell you this much, Wes. It's not the last pool game we're going to see this year.
All right.
They are going to be coming out with some other ones. So we'll have to see how it stacks up, because prior to this, I think, the last pool game, I think, was like a black and white one that Atari made in like 78 or something.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm ready to see some more of them.
Yeah. But there were some clones of this one. Specifically, we've got Tri-Pool by Game Technics and Pro Billiards by SNK. We also have another honorable mention here coming up next. It's called Titan by NSM, came out sometime in 1981. It was a Pac-Man clone, but it did have some pretty crazy spaceman theming I liked. So at least it was a little bit different, but still felt very much like Pac-Man, so we didn't cover it.
All right, now let's talk about some prototype handhelds from Atari. Never released, but some people got their hands on at least this first one, which was called Cosmos. It was a prototype console that used holographic images, like you can almost like you would think of on a holographic playing card, if people still know what those are. And it created a sort of 3D effect for the game backgrounds. The digital aspect of the game, though, was just like the red VFD or LED handheld style games that we've seen before. And then they also had Spectre, which was another prototype, and it was actually a three-person holographic table game prototype by Atari, but it didn't make it nearly as far in production as Cosmos did, so we have even less information about that one.
Yep, but let's move on to a home console now, the VC4000. And we don't talk about this one very often, but it is still kicking. It's still making a lot of games. We've already covered, I think, 19 games for the system, and we're going to do another 6 today. In total, there must have been something like 10 to 12 games released this year, so I ended up breaking them off into two different sets. We'll hit the second set later this year. They don't have month release dates for these, so it's just I ended up just breaking them up into groups. The first one here, it was the 20th game for the system, which, by the way, VC4000 was the European name. It kind of took off in Europe. The US name was the Acetronic, so you know it by that name. But the first game here for the VC4000, which they were numbered, so that made it easy to track, was called Melody Simon, and it was basically a short program that allowed you to program short songs and also had a Simon Says game.
And then next we have Intelligence 4 Attack, which plays a game of Reversi and Othello.
I mean, the title at least was cooler. We've got Chess 2, which, you know, there's already a sequel to Chess out. Pretty cool.
Right.
But this is a version of chess with no graphics, so you had to use a real board to play.
Oh boy.
Not the best.
Going back in time. And then we have Pinball, which was just an okay version of Pinball, nothing to write home about. And also Soccer, aka Foosball, which, again, not too great. Definitely played more like foosball than soccer, but not really anything different than what we've seen before.
Yep, and the last one we're going to talk about today is my first review, because it was the best out of this group, and that's not a high, super high bar. But it was called Bowling, otherwise known as Nine Pins. And this one was at least a little bit interesting because I've never heard of Nine Pins. Apparently, it's very popular in Europe as their version of bowling, which I've never heard about.
Okay, yeah.
So I'll talk about that a little. But yeah, this is a very kind of basic bowling game where the bowling mechanic is you've got a dude at the bottom of the screen. You kind of run up to the lane by just kind of moving your joystick up. And your guy will shoot the ball. You can then put the English on it a little bit. I think you have to do it before bowling because it seemed like it was just kind of moving in random directions when I did it. Like when I was pressing buttons as it was going down the lane, nothing was happening, and then it would turn at the end. So I'm assuming one of those buttons I pressed said, hey, turn it, you know? And then it just always turns at a certain spot. But that's kind of the extent of the bowling mechanic, just kind of run up to the lane. You can kind of scoot your character side to side to get a good lineup and then throw the ball down the lane with some spin on it, and that's it. The pins are just red squares, so they're not very interesting. There's no animation of them toppling over, but they do, like, if you hit the first pin, you can get a strike as they'll, like, kind of topple. They'll be, like, simulated topping down, you know, or falling down and hitting other things. So we've seen this type of bowling game a lot. I think the perspective is a little interesting on this one because you kind of have like a behind the bowler camera almost. Like you're looking at the back of the bowler and it's like you're kind of looking straight down the bowling lane. And we have seen bowling games where they bowl from the side, where like where you're starting on the left and you bowl to the right of the screen, but this is like at the bottom and you bowl up.
Right. Yeah.
But other than that, the game has, I think, 16 variations, which is kind of crazy. It's, it reminds me of the old days of home console games where Atari had like a game that had like 40 variations.
Right.
But this has 16 variations of bowling. Some of the variations go between 9-pin bowling and 10-pin bowling, which is like a US version of bowling. But some of the other options you could enable here, you had some 2-player options, some 1-player options, which they just called training. There was different ways to score or different amounts of balls you could have per frame. So sometimes, like, I think even in the in official 9-pin bowling, you bowl and you only have one ball, and then after that ball goes through and you knock down some pins, it immediately resets and 9 new pins are set up. Or you could do it where you, like, you have 3 balls or as many as it takes to knock them all down, and then it resets. You could also do it where you play to a certain number of points, like first person to 99 points wins. There was also an interesting mode. They called it fox hunting, but it's essentially like a handicap where one person starts with a certain amount of points ahead of the other person, and the other person has to catch up. They had some okay variations here. Nothing too crazy, but I did enjoy learning about 9-pin bowling, which I've never heard of before. The arrangement of those pins kind of reminds me of like a 3x3 cube that's just kind of turned to be a diamond. So it's basically set up in a kind of grid kind of looking pattern, but it does seem like it would be kind of harder to hit them all down. I don't know. Certainly in the video game, the pins are like too wide apart that it would physically make any sense for that you to be able to get a strike, but I don't know. I've never played 9-pin bowling, but it seems kind of cool. Seems interesting. But that's kind of all the game is. So I think I'm just going to head straight into my ratings. So for gameplay, I ended up giving it a 2.75 out of 10. I think this is as good as any bowling game we've seen. Maybe not my favorite. I think maybe some of the bowling games on the Apple II have looked a little bit better, a little bit more visually distinct than this. It's just very blocky. But for gameplay-wise, I gave it a 2.75 just because of all the variations. There's a lot of cool two-player modes, like taking turns, or you guys bowl simultaneously, and it would feel more like a race at that point, I guess, if, especially if you're playing like first to 99 points or something. Might be kind of cool. So the gameplay was decent, but nothing too crazy. I don't really know how high a bowling game could possibly get, to be honest. For graphics, I gave that a 2.75 out of 10. There are quite a few colors on screen. We've got some yellow bowlers, and you can tell there's a body, there's a head, there's an arm. There's no hand, but there's an arm. And the bowling ball is just a white, relatively small bowling ball. It kind of looks like the size of like a golf ball or something, but it works, I guess. The lane feels kind of weirdly short because of the perspective, but the pins are decently large. They're square, which is not the best, but they're red on a blue bowling lane. You've got a light blue, I don't know, I'm sure there's a term for it, but the part of the bowling alley before the lane starts. And then you've got like a pink boundary in between the lane. And there's always two lanes on screen, even if you're playing one player. Pretty normal, I would say, for games like this. And there's a score that pops up whenever you score. They do animate the ball kind of going through the gutter system back to you. So that's good. I don't know. I thought it was decent with all the graphics or with all the colors, really. And they did make an effort to like make a good bowling player. Like, we've played a lot of bowling games where you're playing as the invisible player and there's just a ball that you can basically
right.
just line up and shoot down the lane. So I like that they added the player. So I don't know. I thought it was all right, but nothing great. So just 2.75 there. For sound, I gave that, I don't know, I gave it a 1.5. Maybe that's a little high because the game has no sound effects except for when you hit down a pin, and it plays like a gunshot noise when you hit the pins, which I kind of like. You would never expect it, but right. I think it's kind of fun, and that's the only sound effect it has. Like, obviously it needs some music or something, but it just kind of surprised me hearing these gunshot sound effects. So I didn't go high. I mean, at 1.5 out of 10, it's not high, but considering that's the only sound in the game, maybe it is high, but I'm being a little easy on it, I guess. For relevance, I couldn't think that this was very relevant. I did look it up. I was surprised that Ninepin was even on here. And I realized that this game did not get ported to the Acetronic. That was the US version of the console. It only came out in Europe. So I guess that's why Ninepin is like a big part of it.
Hmm.
Especially because it wasn't even released in the US. I couldn't go high on the relevance. I just gave it a 4 out of 10. Maybe if you live in Europe, you played this game and you thought it was cool. But I don't think it was a whole lot of people. So overall, I gave it a 2.25 out of 10. I think it's okay, but it's not as good as most Intellivision games at this point. I think even Atari 2600 games are kind of just adding a little bit more fidelity to the game and just opting for more in-depth gameplay rather than a lot of variations. Like, we're kind of... I think the variation style of making games has really gone downhill. Like, people don't do it anymore.
Yeah.
So to see this, it kind of brought back some memories of the old days of us doing the podcast, but I do think it's fallen out of style for a good reason. It's very similar, and they would have been better to have some sort of maybe like a versus AI mode or something, which they don't have. Yeah, I think it's okay, but not great. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels like almost... in the early days that, and who knows, maybe we'll see a comeback of the 64 game variations, but it feels like it was sort of, how do we, with the limited capabilities we have, make more game time for people to play, like more interest in playing the game again and again? Whereas now it feels like you can just be like, well, what if we make the game better and more interesting? We don't need 20 variations. You know, that's just speculation, but it feels like, you know, 16 variations is kind of making do with what you got as opposed to making the game you want to make.
Yeah, exactly. And what's interesting is that the VC4000 came out after the Atari 2600. And so the Atari 2600, I think, has been investing more into the cartridge capabilities, right? They're getting more out of their system because they're kind of investing some more money, and they're only doing that because they're seeing that investment pay off in sales. So if you don't have those sales and you're not doing that investment, like, this is as good as it's going to get for this kind of era of technology, I think. So, but that being said, there is a second set of games coming out later this year we'll take a look at, and I think the VC4000 is around for a number of years yet, so
okay.
We'll keep checking out. Who knows what they'll do.
All right, yeah, so we'll have to keep following that, but for now we are going to move on from console games and onto some computer games. The first one we have here is Chenault's Flying Tigers by Discovery Games. It was for the Big Three computers and the Atari 8-bit. It's kind of half strategy game, half turret gunning flight sim type game. The graphics looked okay in the dogfights, but not great in the strategy part, so we didn't end up covering it.
Yep, and up next we have an honorable mention called Intruder Alert by Dynacop and Artworks. I believe that is the same company. They just rebranded or something. This is a clear attempt at a Berserk port to the Atari 8-bit, but it does not run very well. At least you have a multi-level shooter with some nice graphics and sound effects, though, so I wanted to mention that.
Yeah, that's at least something. All right, now let's move on to the second game that I reviewed for today. It is called Fantasyland 2041 AD. What a title. And you can take or leave the AD because it's been in the game. It's only called Fantasyland 2041. This is by Crystalware. And again, we're in April right now, but this came out sometime in 1981. So we just ended up putting it here. And this game is going to come out on the Apple II and the Atari 8-bit. The version I ended up taking a look at was the Apple II version, although I did look at some video from the Atari 8-bit version as well. A little bit of background on this game. The manual has really in-depth story. I forget the lead developer who was making this at Crystalware, but he really went all out. And it even states in the year 2020 is when the first real Android was created. So, you know, not too far off. I don't know if we've made the first real Android yet. He might have been a little bit optimistic, but I always love seeing the current year in like these far future games. But the setting for this game is absolutely crazy. It's basically a spinoff or like a take on Westworld, which is the idea of like in the future, a theme park where rich people can pay to like live these experiences of, you know, in Westworld, it's you're pretending you're a cowboy, except it's real stakes. You might actually die out there and stuff like that. So Fantasyland 2041 is the same kind of theme where you spend loads of money to go on adventures. And in Fantasyland, there are adventures in Congo Land, Arabia, Camelot, Olympus, underwater with Captain Nemo, and Dante's Inferno. So it's really covering the whole gamut. There's lots of different adventures. And okay. Emmanuel actually has a unique story in the manual for each adventure that you go on, or each of these lands that you can go to. And it's all about a different person who is at Fantasyland exploring. So like the first one is somebody named Tisha and her adventures in Congo Land. And it's just, I don't know, to give a little bit of extra theming to it. So it's interesting that each one has that story to it. The game is also huge. It originally shipped on, I think, 7 different floppy disks or something like that. So I don't know if you had to buy them all separately or what, but it was a big game. And the creator said they had to make it really long and really difficult to justify the price, and that they expect most people who play it will never beat it. And after playing it and watching other people play it, I can see why they said that. But let me talk about the gameplay now. The game itself is strange, but it basically boils down to an adventure game with lots of different levels. The creators previously made Beneath the Pyramids, which is a kind of adventure game where you go screen to screen, finding treasure, fighting enemies along the way, getting to the end, and then escaping to the exit to win the game. And this is the same basic loop for all of the different lands and adventures that you go on. It does mix in some text adventure elements where you have to have certain items in your inventory to make it past puzzles and the final boss. And fighting is done on a turn-by-turn basis, and it's based off your total party strength. Your individual character can't really get much stronger other than having armor and weapons in your inventory, but you can recruit lots of companions who can also have armor and weapons in their inventory. And it's sort of like just increasing your total combat power. And then when you fight someone, if your combat power is higher than yours, they lose more combat power per turn than you do. And it's sort of this turn by turn battle of attrition sort of thing. You also have rations that get consumed automatically as you walk, and you have to buy them at towns or at the beginning of the game. And the more people you have in your party, the more rations you consume. So you can't just recruit everybody that you see, because if your rations run out, I think it's instant death from what I've read. So it's pretty brutal, and you want to make sure you balance your rations versus how many companions you have. On the bright side, you can save at any time during the game. So I guess they expected people to die a lot and just keep continuing from where they were last. And in the breakdown of the game is sort of that the first 3 levels, which are Congo Land, Adventure in Arabia, and Camelot, they're all pretty similar. You have to navigate different terrain, like mountains and swamps. And when you're traveling through these, you often lose rations or other equipment. If you encounter hazards, you also encounter groups of enemies that you have to fight. And in each of these levels, you find a local sorcerer or witch doctor, depending on the theming, that you have to fight, make friends with, and then find your way to the end of the level, which is either a temple or King Solomon's castle, something like that. And you have to use the sorcerer's power to proceed to the next level. So you do that for the first 3 levels. But then after that, you go to Olympus and you have to buy a ship and sail between islands. So that's a little bit different. Then in Captain Nemo's adventure, you have to get into a submarine where you're limited on how much equipment and party members you can carry with you. And you kind of explore by sending divers out or something. It seemed very strange. And then in Dante's Inferno, the last level, you have to fight demons and confront Lucifer. Same basic gameplay, but it does have a little bit of different navigation and fighting to it. And then the whole goal of this adventure is to rescue either Guinevere or Lancelot, depending on your preference. And then after you rescue them from Lucifer, you have to backtrack through every single level and get back to the beginning to win. So it's not an easy task. And I can't believe CRPG Addict even was determined enough to do it, because boy, I sure wasn't, but he beat it. So credit to him. And they keep teasing in the manual and as you're going through the game that once you beat the game, there's this secret, great, hidden mystery to the game other than just beating it, that if you figure it out and you let the creators know, they would give you $1,000. But I'm not sure if it was ever figured out. CRPG Addict could never figure out what's going on. I mean, it could be a play on the whole Westworld thing where there's like a game within the game that you play, but I don't know if it was just a hoax or if there actually was a deeper meaning to it. There are some cryptic poems in the manual, and the number 666 appears a couple times throughout the game, so maybe there is something to explore here, but I don't think I'm going to be the one to solve it. All right, but with that being said, let me get into my ratings now for Fantasyland 2041. For graphics, I gave it a 1.5 out of 10. Unfortunately, in both the Atari 8-bit and Apple II versions, Fantasyland didn't have great graphics. I mean, they're pretty simple. There's a representation of your character that's thankfully a bit more detailed than a stick figure. And there's surroundings like mountains, bushes, rivers, fish that all look fairly simple. But there weren't any visuals for the rest of your party or for most of the enemies that came up and attacked you during the game. Both of the games, both of the versions of the game had some color, but they were mostly black backgrounds, so I couldn't really rate it too high. I did love the variety of landscapes from swamps in the Congo to the fires of hell, but there just wasn't a ton of detail in any of those landscapes. I will say I really appreciate, though, that the Atari 8-bit version scrolled as you moved across the screen, whereas the Apple II version was broken up into sections, and once you moved to the edge of the screen, it had to load a new screen. So the Atari version did have that going for it. For sounds, I only gave it a 1 out of 10. I didn't hear many sounds on the Apple II version, but the Atari version apparently did have different beeps to signify that battles were over or fights were happening, and also certain noises for being underwater to kind of symbolize that you were in a submarine, but nothing too crazy, so can't give it too many points, although I do always love hearing sound on an early computer game. That's still kind of a novel thing. For gameplay, I honestly wasn't having a great time with this. I only gave it a 1.75 out of 10 for gameplay. The theming is super wild, and I love it, but the gameplay just ends up being, despite all these crazy different themes, repetitive and kind of simple. And also very difficult for no other reason than, like, they needed to make the game take a long time, which is understandable, but still a little frustrating. The combat of whoever has the biggest party wins, basically, is just kind of boring, and I'm not really a fan of the rations being such a strict penalty. I feel like they should give you a little bit more wiggle room there. To be fair, they did have these cool interactable points throughout the world, like banana trees in the Congo, that you could actually get more rations from. So there was kind of some fun way to mitigate that way. But for the most part, the whole game just felt like wearing the player down over time through attrition, seeing how well you balance resources, and there wasn't really much more tactical play in the way that I would like. The main quest also isn't very compelling to me. You're just in this amusement park, and then you have to rescue somebody from the devil for some reason. I don't really get it. Although I do really like the Westworld parallels in it, being a fan of the new show, although I did never watch the original one back in the day. But that intricate, cool theming didn't really come across as fun gameplay, unfortunately. For relevance, I gave it a 6 out of 10. Fantasyland 2041 is a series of adventure in sequence that's pretty unique for its time, and it's not quite like the Eamon system. So it's definitely got its own unique thing going on, and it's cool to see a game that I'm pretty sure is inspired by Westworld. So even though it won't inspire other games, I still think it's fairly relevant for that reason. And overall, I gave it a 1.5 out of 10. Fantasyland 2041 is an ambitious game for sure, with tons of story in the manual, but no real compelling elements in the actual game for me. Its size is impressive, and I could see it being a challenge people might want to take on just because of how big it is. But for me, the gameplay wasn't really gripping enough to get me much further than the first level in the Congo.
Okay. Yeah, the party system kind of reminds me more of the Robert Clardy Wilderness Campaign.
Wilderness Campaign, yeah. There's definitely some interesting stuff to this one, but it just felt like a little bit too much of a grind for me.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm glad we checked it out.
Yeah, for sure.
My next game, and the last one we have for today, is Cranston Manor. It's the big one. It's Sierra Online's third high-res adventure game after, what was it, Frog and the Princess and Haunted Mansion, which I think I did.
Yeah, I believe so.
I think this is the next one. Maybe I'm missing one there, but this is high-res adventure number 3, and I had to check it out because Sierra Online is like going to be, you know, the number one maker of text adventures, even kicking Scott Adams to the curb. So I felt like we had to cover this one. And this one has a really interesting kind of backstory to it, because the original creator of the game, it didn't come from Sierra Online's party or crew. It came from a third-party developer who basically sold the game to them. Hmm. And he originally, the guy's name is Larry Ledden. He originally sold this game as a pure text adventure, so no visuals, to Dynacomp and Artworks. And what's interesting is that game was then sold to Sierra Online and made into a graphical text adventure with graphics for everything. But it's one of these text adventures where it's one of the only ones we've come across where there's a surviving like text adventure version with no graphics.
Hmm.
And then the same game has a graphic version that was released pretty much at the same time. They both released in 81, and we decided not to cover the just purely text one. We are going to cover this graphic one. But what's interesting about it is there's a lot of great insights I read from Blue Ranga, and he also credits a data-driven gamer who we have definitely checked out a lot of his stuff before as well, in regards to the differences between the two versions and what I'm assuming a lot of people at the time felt about graphic text adventures versus non-graphic text adventures. Because for us, it's like, obviously we want to see graphics, but to the people back then, it wasn't so obvious. And I think this game has a good example of why that might be the case. So before I get into that point, I want to quickly mention what the game is. It is a collect the treasures game, which is kind of annoying. You collect 13 treasures. I'll read out the background so you kind of get the story. This background comes from the manual of the game. It says, Old Man Cranston trusted no one. He accumulated his immense wealth through questionable means. Before being dragged to his grave by cancer, he hid his treasures on his estate. Now it is suspected that he still haunts the mansion and grounds guarding his treasure. You are in the deserted town of Coarsegold, which was strangled to death through Old Man Cranston's greed and plotting. You are determined to enter Cranston Manor, find the treasures, and put them outside the gates so that they can be used to rejuvenate Coarsegold. You have a list of 16 treasures Old Man Cranston stole and hid, but it is not legible. And that's how the game starts, or at least that's what the setup is in the manual. The good things about this game, I'll say really quickly, it's a graphical text adventure in that Sierra style, and the graphics are quite good, I think. Maybe the best that we've seen from them yet. Although I will say, I don't think there's as many characters that need high levels of detail in this one as opposed to some other games. Like, I didn't see any human characters in the game. As far as like other things that would need a high level of detail, there's a suit of armor that follows you around, and that kind of looks like a robot, if I'm being honest, but it looks okay. There's like a mouse. There's a pig, which I think looks really good, or sort of like ox or something. But most of the game is kind of you going through empty rooms, to be honest. There's not a whole lot. Like, the town is deserted and nobody's living in the mansion, so kind of all deserted. And also, a lot of gameplay changes that were made between the text adventure version and this version would really benefit players like us. So for example, things like mazes where you just kind of walk around in a circle forever were kind of removed or heavily simplified in this version, which is great.
Hmm.
There was no inventory limit in this version, so that's good. Things like a lamp going out was not implemented in this one. It's just always on. Certain bugs were fixed. These seem like pretty nice bonuses to the graphical version as opposed to the text adventure version. So why is it that Blue Ranga and some other reviewers preferred the text adventure version? And I think the answer comes down to when it's in text, you can kind of imply a lot of detail, but in 1981, you can't graphically draw a lot of detail. So a great example of this is that in the text adventure version, like you walk into a chapel, which is in the mansion, and the chapel has like stained glass windows. It's got like an altar, like it's saying these things out in text. And then you play the graphical version and you walk in the chapel and it's like a blank room with a cross on it. And that's it. You know right. what I mean?
Yeah.
So you don't get the feeling that you get when you read the text because you're kind of imagining what it is and it's grand. And then you play the graphic adventure and it's like a room with nothing in it because they can't draw anything in more high level of a detail. So
right. That
really comes across in this game. It felt kind of weird. The graphics, like, you would assume with something like Cranston Manor and with the introduction that I mentioned that this would be kind of a spooky mansion looking thing. But the rooms are in fact painted in bright colors. There's like a lively garden outside, like there's a hedge maze and stuff, and it's all green and beautiful. And like, I don't know, it doesn't feel creepy at all. It feels like you're just walking in an empty house that's like well decorated, you know? And there's a robot following you around for some reason. It kind of loses a lot of spookiness, I think. It's not like they can draw cobwebs on the walls or anything. So it just feels like a big empty building with nothing really in it. And it kind of just feels generic and kind of boring to look at, even if it is drawn kind of well. So I totally get that. I think that's a legit criticism. And I could see why people might prefer the text adventure version because they can kind of immerse yourself into a world that the game is trying to sell you. You know, it's trying to sell that this is a haunted mansion. And you just don't really buy it once you look at the graphics. So I don't know. I think it's an interesting thing I hadn't really ever thought about before our previous graphical text adventures, because there was no text version of them, so we couldn't do like a one-to-one comparison. But yeah, a lot of the room descriptions were changed slightly. They're not as specific, because if they were, they wouldn't be able to render it right. So just something interesting to think about. But I think with all that being said, I'm kind of ready to move into my ratings of the game. For gameplay, I ended up giving it a 2.75 out of 10. I still think the game plays pretty well. I mean, it's a collect the treasures, which I don't like, but I do like a lot of the things they changed. I mean, no inventory limit, no lamp burning out, no mazes. It was a lot more straightforward, and it was kind of that style of text adventure since you are collecting the treasures, where you can explore a lot more of the map without getting stuck. If you get stuck, maybe that, you know, further down that path is a treasure, but there's another 12 paths. So it kind of felt like you could explore a lot, even if you didn't find any treasure, which was, for me, still fun and enjoyable. So I thought it was pretty fun. I mean, I'd much rather play a game like this than a normal text adventure, I think purely because of mapping. Because in a normal text adventure game, you have to draw the map yourself on a piece of paper. But if it's got graphics to it, there's landmarks, and you just kind of remember it better, I think.
Right.
So to me, it was a lot easier to play, and I enjoyed it a fair amount, even though there are some issues with it. I gave that a 2.75. For graphics, I gave that a 3.25, because I think these might be the best graphics that we've seen yet. There wasn't a whole lot to the graphics that really needed to be drawn, but that also meant that we didn't get like a picture of a wizard and his face was all like discombobulated. So everything that was drawn looked fairly real, even if it was undetailed. Like, it was a lot of empty rooms, but the rooms looked fine. They were very colorful. One thing that I do want to mention that I thought was really good is later in the game, you go in a cave or down into a dungeon or something, and they actually have, instead of the hallways just being straight, narrow, square hallways, it's very clear that you're in a tunnel and the walls are curved. And I've never really seen that in a graphic text adventure before, so I really appreciated the fact that we were in a curved walled cave instead of like being straight vertical walls on the side of a cave, which we have seen previously. So I liked that quite a bit. And for what characters that were there, I really enjoyed them. They'd had that thing where sometimes objects that you needed to interact with were drawn on screen, and that can be both good and bad. It is cool when you pick something up and then it's gone from the scene. Stuff like that is still here. So I thought it looked okay. I felt there was a little bit more detail to this one than there was in Wizard and the Princess. So I wanted to bump up the graphics slightly. For sound, I had to give that a 1 because there's only some beeps that play occasionally. And this was especially annoying to me because at one point you have to play the organ to open up a secret passage, and I thought for sure that it would play a sound effect, and it didn't play anything. It was quiet. I was like, come on, how can you do that to me? Yeah, I couldn't do anything other than a 1 for some beeps. For relevance, I gave it a 6.5 out of 10. It is Sierra Online's third high-res adventure. There's a lot of buzz about them. They're doing very well. They're big in the scene right now. I do think probably a lot of people played this. It's a little unfortunate because Larry Ledden, the guy who made the game, he sold it to Sierra Online, and he did get royalties, but he was not credited in the game. So it looked like it came from Ken Williams, who made most of the other ones, I think. So I feel bad for him because most people don't know him. I feel like they should because he made some a great text adventure and deserves credit. So I definitely want to mention him. But yeah, I think it's pretty relevant just because I think it's pretty popular. And I do think it's the best looking text adventure to date. It's on the Apple II, and there's lots of color to it, as I mentioned, maybe too much for the actual setting. But I do think the graphics are a little bit more high res than previous iterations, or just the art style has kind of tightened up a little bit. So I thought it was pretty good and deserves some relevant points. And overall, I gave it a 2.75 out of 10. I didn't quite average out the scores. I kind of gave it what I felt it should be, which is a 2.75 out of 10. It's interesting hearing the differences between this and the real text adventure. And I get some of the criticisms of the time for sure. That being said, I would still rather play this than the original text adventure by a long shot. So I think it is still an improvement, even though eventually the graphics will get to a point where they can do a better job actually representing like a cool cathedral and make it look like a cathedral. Right now it looks like a room, and that's got to improve, but I think it will, and we're kind of seeing the evolution of that with games like this. Definitely a fun one to take a look at.
Yeah, very cool. I mean, it's, yeah, like the argument of book versus movie. You know, when it's in a book, you can imagine the characters to look however way you want them. But when they're in a movie, it's, no, this is how they look. So it's kind of that aspect, okay, too, where it's like, takes away a bit of your creative freedom in your imagination. So an interesting argument, and it sounds like a pretty solid text adventure.
Yeah, yeah. So that will do it for us today. I hope you guys enjoyed it. We did Tri Pool and then Bowling and Nine Pins on the VC 4000. And Wes, you covered Fantasyland 2041, adventure game with some graphical text adventure elements. And then I did Cranston Manor Adventure by Online Systems, or Sierra Online. That was a graphical text adventure, their third high res text adventure. And this is the new big kids on the block. So I'm really excited to look up any game when it comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. And make sure to follow us on our website, where we've got tons of great information on all these different creators, and depending on their name change, Online System or Sierra. And, look back on Greg Hassett and Mad Hatter Systems as well. Also, make sure to follow us on X or Twitter, as it was previously known, for updates. And if you have any questions, feel free to send us an email.
And with that, we'll catch you next time.
See you all next time.